Peter B. Collins News and Comments. It's Thursday, May 28th, 2020. Once again, the mainstream media coverage is dominated by Trump's new self-defeating war on Twitter. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But it is a distraction from a much more significant struggle that's going on in Washington, D.C., that sees the tables turned. And these are issues that are much more important than, you know, Trump's ability to trash tweet on a daily basis. It has to do with what is left of our Fourth Amendment rights and the pervasive government surveillance of Americans in the United States. And the tables have turned. Because for all the wrong reasons, Trump instructed his Republican cronies in the House of Representatives to vote against a bill that is essentially the same as the one that most of them voted for just a couple of months ago before it was sent over to the Senate, where enough changes were made that it had to come back to the House for a final round of approval. And the other confounding element of this is that Democratic leaders, including Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff of the Intelligence Committee, are all on board to extend the surveillance powers of the government, which Trump could use and abuse against them and against us. And it's a little complicated, but it's even more disgusting. So allow me, will you? So today, House Democratic leaders withdrew the bill that would revive expired FBI tools to investigate terrorism and espionage. And they claimed that it would add privacy protections for Americans subjected to wiretapping for national security purposes. But this obscures the fundamental obscenity of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the Star Chamber Court that it legally enables. And so I watch Nancy Pelosi dance around these issues, and the PBS NewsHour doesn't conduct very difficult or challenging interviews, but even Judy Woodruff was a little perplexed as she heard Pelosi talk out of both sides of her mouth. What Nancy was saying was, well, this is a better bill than the one that we passed a few months ago because the Senate improved it. And that ignores what I just said, that you're making modest changes to a law that digs deeply into eroding our rights under the very simple language of the Fourth Amendment. And because Trump is now opposed to it, for petty reasons because of the Carter Page case at the FISA court, that's the only interest he has. He doesn't care about the FISA court and the fact that hundreds of people have had their rights violated over the years, that the FBI in particular has routinely lied to the judges of the FISA court, and those judges knew it and objected to it and couldn't do a damn thing about it. And only after the Carter Page warrants and renewal of those warrants were exposed in December by an inspector general report. And remember, Trump is busy firing every damn inspector general in sight. So the contradictions here are so thick and numerous that it's easier just to focus on Trump trying to bully Twitter. But these issues have long-lasting implications. And someday Trump won't be president. We all live with that light at the end of a very dark and long tunnel. But right now he is. There's a good chance he's going to get reelected in November. And the idea that Democrats would be fighting tooth and nail to get this piece of shit passed by covering it in whipped cream and putting a cherry on top and saying, well, if the Republicans are against it, it's got to be good. This is so disgusting. So back to the New York Times account here. Support for the measure among Republicans cratered after Trump intervened to urge them to reject it. and some progressives said they can't support the bill without greater privacy protections. Good for them, but they don't have the votes. And so if you remember Zoe Lofgren, she's the veteran congresswoman from San Jose, chairs the one of the committees. I'm sorry, I can't think of it right now. She was one of the lawyers who presented the impeachment arguments. And I have a lot of respect for Zoe Lofgren. And she's working inside the system in the dirty process of crafting this legislative sausage. And she found herself at odds with Adam Schiff, right? He's the hero of Russiagate, the hero of impeachment, which, by the way, I underscore was valid, unlike the Russiagate scandal that he promoted shamelessly for years. And so Lofgren versus Schiff. And Pelosi is trying to thread the needle here, but she clearly tilts toward surveillance, not the Fourth Amendment. Mitch McConnell is her ally in this game. And do you hear anybody say, kill the FISA court, end the FISA law entirely, scrap it? Why is it that the ordinary federal courts are not seen as able to conduct, secretly when needed, processes to issue warrants for legitimate national security investigations? Nobody asked that question. Nobody looks at this and says, wait a minute. This is un-American. This is unconstitutional. And it has been normalized ever since the Patriot Act was passed, and elements of the Patriot Act are part of this stinky package. And I love the voice of the New York Times protecting its investment. A small part of the Russia investigation included surveillance authorized by FISA that targeted Carter Page, a former campaign advisor with close ties to Moscow. Well, close ties? Maybe he has friends in Moscow and a favorite restaurant. But he doesn't have close ties to the Kremlin. I digress. An inspector general report later uncovered myriad errors and omissions in the applications for the wiretap, and Trump has sought to undercut the legitimacy of the broader inquiry by citing the problematic wiretapping of his former aide. Now, as I said, Trump opposes this for personal and selfish reasons. And just like scrapping Obamacare, he doesn't have a clue about what he would do to modify or replace the FISA law. Because he can't think that deeply. Oh, he's a stable genius, but he operates in the moment at a depth of 1 millimeter. So they tell us that the Senate improved it, adding new layers of oversight to FISA wiretap applications by instructing judges, who normally hear only from the Justice Department, to appoint outsiders to critique the government's arguments in more types of cases, including those involving political campaigns or religious organizations. Now, this is the same bullshit they've been promoting every 5 years or so when they renew this piece of crap. Oh, yeah, we modified it, and there's an ombudsman who's going to be in the courtroom. Well, unless there is a defense attorney for the individual who is targeted in such a wiretap, this is meaningless. So then we get Bill Barr over at the Justice Department, who plays Trump's lawyer and attorney general all at the same time. And here comes whiplash, I'm warning you. He said that he would tell Trump to veto the bill because he thought it would impose too many restrictions on law enforcement and national security authorities. And in its dry voice, the Times calls this a complicated spectacle of political and policy dysfunction. And forgive my strong language, but I call it a clusterfuck. The article goes on, traditionally, Democrats have tended to be somewhat more reluctant than Republicans to grant broad national security powers to the government. But here, Democrats appear to be the ones more eager to see the legislation passed. That's right. You've got Steny Hoyer, the number two House Democrat. chiding the GOP. Two-thirds of the Republican Party voted for this bill in March. They now indicate they're going to vote against it. I'm told they're doing so at the request of the president. I believe this to be against the security interest of the United States and the safety of the American people. So the Democrats, who were against surveillance when Bush did it, then supported surveillance when Obama normalized and made it permanent. And now they want to be the number one party. And this is also a side effect of Russiagate, where the Democrats, for political partisan purposes, in order to explain the stunning loss of Hillary Clinton in 2016, blamed Putin and concocted this whole scheme that's now unraveling. And oh, there's so many Democrats who can't face that word if I say it's unraveling or crumbling. They are clinging to the innuendo-based Russiagate narrative. And that leads them hand in glove into supporting the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and the routine violations of the Fourth Amendment. And despite the accurate criticisms of The Intercept in the article I commented on the other day by Ben Norton at The Gray Zone, and the way The Intercept sold out Reality Winner when she leaked classified information to that media organization, they have a pretty good rundown on this whole bizarre scene by Ryan Grimm and Alex Emmons, which is was written late yesterday before they knew that the House ultimately wouldn't vote on this bill. And just to be clear, the bill will go back to the Senate and back to a conference committee where Pelosi hopes they can touch it up and get it passed. But with the threat of the veto from Trump, again for the wrong reasons, who knows where this will ultimately end up. And this also links to the criticism that I leveled at Bernie Sanders just a couple of weeks ago. Because when the Senate tried to pass a measure, an amendment to this package, that would limit the FBI's ability to access web browsing history and other online activity without a warrant, it failed by a single vote, and Bernie Sanders didn't show up. The hell's that about, St. Bernard? So the article here, the Intercept piece, describes how Zoe Lofgren is the leader of the civil libertarians in the House, and that Adam Schiff is the one promoting surveillance. You can't make this stuff up. So let's quote a little bit here. The politics of surveillance, even in normal times, scramble the typical partisan tendencies, with Senate Majority Leader McConnell, Pelosi, and Schiff often aligning on questions about the breadth and depth of state power to surveil and track Americans. Opposing those congressional leaders is the civil liberties community, which includes both progressives and conservatives with libertarian leanings, but which rarely can muster a majority in Congress for its defense of the Bill of Rights. The civil liberties argument has gained new traction in recent months with Trump's outrage over the FISA court. And here comes the comic relief, all right? Have you ever heard Louis Gohmert talk? Now, he's a former judge from Texas, and it's not just his southern drawl. He is a cartoon character of the furthest right of the right wing. And Wednesday morning at a Rules Committee hearing, he said, you know, it sure seems strange to me. I won't even try to mimic his accent, okay? For Democrats to vote for this reauthorization, even with these amendments, would have to be sort of saying, we have so much trust in Donald Trump and the people he's appointed that they would never lie to a FISA court. They would never just go after their enemies. We feel like he can be trusted, and so can all the people he's appointed. Well, we know he's cleaned out some folks at the Justice Department, FBI. I mean, think about it. Now, this is what makes this so bizarre. Louis Gohmert recognizes what the Democrats are doing. Oh, boy. So, quoting again from The Intercept, the unlikely coalition of Trump and the civil libertarians was enough to stall the legal reauthorization of the FBI's Call Detail Records program, an amended version of the Patriot Act that allowed federal law enforcement to collect your phone records. And all that did was shift the custody of your phone call records to your phone company. And it required the agency that wanted to look at them, most likely the FBI, to ask the phone company for them instead of just pulling them up on their own computer terminals. This is the fiction of the improvements in these bills that sell out your constitutional rights. So after they kind of hit the wall here, earlier this month, the Senate reauthorized the programs with additional restrictions, but an amendment that would limit the government's ability to collect internet browsing history without a warrant fell one short. That's where Bernie was absent. Pelosi then instructed Schiff to come up with a compromise version with Zoe Lofgren rather than allow an up or down vote on the Senate language. The result was an amendment introduced by Lofgren and a Republican, Warren Davidson from Ohio, that reintroduced the restriction on collecting browsing history, but it applies only to U.S. persons. And as you know, that's a huge loophole, because if my browsing involves a website outside the United States or communications with an individual who's not technically a U.S. person, well, they can get that information, but then my identity is masked until they unmask it. So this is just a huge mess. And I bring it to your attention and rant in such detail here because it truly defines the Democratic Party of 2020. And it's an ugly, ugly profile of who they represent and what they stand for. So I have another couple of quickies here before we get to Trump's war on Twitter. ACLU filed a lawsuit. It's in Chicago, but it covers the whole country, against a facial recognition startup called Clearview AI. They have collected what is believed to be billions of photos, more than 3 billion, in a database, and they grabbed your pictures from Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Venmo, wherever they could get them. Driver's license databases, if they could get in there. And they sell it for commercial purposes. And if somebody who subscribes to Clearview AI and pays them asks for a picture of Peter B. Collins, oh, I say, really, we got a whole gallery here. You want one with the microphone and headphones, or one with his family, one with him on vacation in Italy? What do you want to see? Then we have another commercial exploitation that violates your privacy. This is a company that collects information and then sells it to people who are running background checks on those who want to rent properties from them. And the article opens like a description written by Greg Palast about Chris Kobach's interstate cross-check list. They describe a woman from St. Helens, Oregon, Samantha Johnson. She applied to rent an apartment in St. Helens, Oregon in 2018. But when her file was run, well, she was accused of burglary and domestic assault in Minnesota, selling meth, jumping bail in Kentucky, driving without insurance in Arkansas, disorderly conduct, theft, lying to a cop. And, of course, none of these charges related to her. But it was people who had similar names, and the data is sloppily organized so that almost any Samantha and almost any Johnson would produce a file. This was the same, as I say, that was used to purge voters from the rolls on the phony basis that people were voting in more than one jurisdiction in the same election. So Samantha Johnson said it was such a joke There were four Samantha Johnsons and a woman who had used the name as an alias, even though the screening report said she was an active inmate in a Kentucky jail at the time. And the real Samantha said, "You can totally tell we're not the same person at all." And so this is how your privacy is being violated, how the internet and lax law enforcement, contempt for the Fourth Amendment, it all piles up to the point where there is so much information out there that can be used against you. All right. So now we get to Trump. And you remember when Melania launched her First Lady campaign? You know, no organic garden. She's not going to fight breast cancer or anything like that. She wanted to fight online bullying. And what is her tagline is either be better or be best. Whatever it is, it's a joke. But clearly, the man that she never sleeps with hasn't gotten the message. So Trump may have done so by now, but he is set to sign an executive order that could open the door for federal regulators to punish Facebook, Google, and Twitter for the way they police content online. So what Trump is threatening to do through an executive order that has no teeth is to order federal regulators who have no jurisdiction over these online platforms to do something about it. And so this is just Trump spewing a whole lot of bullshit. And what this comes back to is there was the Decency Act, right? Remember when Howard Stern was being a bad boy and the FCC fined him hundreds of thousands of dollars? Well, in 1996, Congress passed the Communications Decency Act, and the section that is in play here is Section 230, because it essentially said that any user-generated content could not lead to liability by the platforms that posted it. And I use the word posted instead of published, all right, because published has a legal interpretation that is very important. And Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, they are allergic to being categorized as publishers, because then they would actually have to have transparent standards used to police content on their platforms. And this is a gray area that the, you know, so-called disrupting technology companies have used to their advantage. So Trump's effort to essentially impose a First Amendment on private companies that have their own First Amendment rights, but their users do not, could, in the irrational way that he cannot consider, I'm sure his advisors have tried to school him on this, but it's pretty clear that if he tries to set up a standard that he can spew whatever he wants on Twitter all day long, that he is the one, the single person, who would most likely suffer a huge setback in what he perceives as his freedom of speech. And so, you know, Twitter is so late to the game. Sure, they've bounced a lot of people for trivial statements and attacks on other Twitter users, but they have allowed Trump just carte blanche. And for the simple move, which is not even like a parking ticket, where they challenged one of his tweets about the vulnerabilities of mail-in voting and said, you know, get the facts. Well, this is where Trump is fighting mad. And I believe he's mostly trying to bully the companies into submission. But in this analysis by Peter Baker and Daisuke Wakabayashi in today's New York Times, they point out that the president, he's threatening punishment that could force social media companies to crack down even more on customers just like him. The executive order would strip liability protection in certain cases for companies like Twitter, Google, and Facebook for the content on their sites, meaning that they could face legal jeopardy if they allowed false and defamatory posts. Without the liability shield, they presumably would have to be more aggressive about policing messages that press the boundaries, like the president's. Now remember, after a court ruling, even upholding Section 230, Craigslist had to take down its adult ads. They didn't want to face the liability for use by prostitutes and, happy ending masseuses. And so they just took away the whole category. And this article argues, the logic of Trump's order is intriguing because it attacks the very legal provision that has allowed him such latitude to publish with impunity a whole host of inflammatory, factually distorted messages that a media provider might feel compelled to take down if it was forced into the legal role of publisher that faced the risk of legal liability rather than a distributor that does not. And this is where I make the case that Mark Zuckerberg, who was on Fox, I guess they published it this morning, and he said, gosh, gee, golly, we don't want to be the arbiter of truth online. Well, he's trying to have it both ways. He does not want to be defined as a publisher. But it's just like Uber is trying to wriggle out of being an employer of the thousands, if not millions, of drivers that work for the company. And we have AB5 here in California, a badly written bill that's an attempt to describe these people that Google wants to define as independent contractors accurately as employees. And Uber and its allies are running a ballot measure to try to defeat that and amend it this fall here in California. But these disruptors, they believe that they're powerful enough now, and they're all, paying big bucks for lobbyists in Washington to promote this disingenuous position, the straddle, if you will. And so I am at a loss to predict how this turns out. What I can confidently predict is that you and I will not be able to express ourselves. Yesterday, I described how Emmy Palmore, a former high-ranking official in the Israeli Ministry of Justice, who directed efforts through third parties in the United States to suppress the speech of people critical of the State of Israel, she's now on this advisory board to censor content at Facebook. And let's face it, Facebook is a publisher, because if something that you post runs afoul of their rules, whether it's copyright or hate speech or political speech or statements that they don't believe are correct, they will either restrict your ability to post in the future, or they just bury the post that you wrote so nobody sees it, and you can't tell it's been buried. Because you have no control over who sees your post once you click it. So the best quote I found today is from Professor Tiffany Lee, L.I., law professor, Boston University. She tweeted that such an executive order claims that tech platforms are doing something they're not in violation of an incorrect interpretation of law, and it tasks agencies it can't task to look into the things that aren't being done that wouldn't be wrong. That's Trump logic for you. Also, and on the blog of Dan Kennedy, which is called Media Nation, it asks that we give credit to Media Nation when we cite its materials. So, Dan, did I give you enough credit there? He posted a brilliant item today. It's brief. I linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. We often hear that Trump has 80 million Twitter followers. But according to analytics from the Fake Followers Audit, 70.2% of his followers are fake, defined as accounts that are unreachable and will not see the account's tweets either because they're spam, bots, propaganda, or because they're no longer active on Twitter. And he's not alone. 43% of Barack Obama's 118 million followers are defined as fake. Bottom line here, says Dan Kennedy, Trump's actual follower base on Twitter is about 24 million. He always inflates his numbers. Billions and billions and billions. So Twitter is continuing so that it doesn't appear to be singling the president out. They added a fact-checking, a truthiness label to a comment from Zhao Lijian, a spokesman for China's foreign ministry, who had claimed that the coronavirus outbreak may have begun in the United States and brought to China by the U.S. military. Now, that's one of many scenarios that I've explored on this podcast. I raise it as a question, as a possibility. And in the language of this news account, it says that he was quoted as saying that it may have come. But it has been determined to be non-factual. Well, it's damn speculation. And Twitter, through the CEO Jack Dorsey, said, "We'll continue to point out incorrect or disputed information." So who gets to decide that? And at what cost to what we thought we had in terms of free speech? I've also linked to a scholarly piece by Peter H. Schuck, emeritus professor of law at Yale, and now a visiting professor across the bay at UC Berkeley's law school. And he says that Trump's insinuation that Joe Scarborough may be responsible for the death in 2001 of Klaus Sudis may be the basis for legal action for which a civil jury could award punitive damages against him. And it runs through the facts that Lori was working for Scarborough in his congressional office. She died in the Florida district office when Scarborough was then in Washington. Police found no evidence of foul play. The coroner said the cause of death was caused by heart disease and directly by a fall against a hard object. No foul play has ever been suggested. But Trump says that some people think that Scarborough got away with murder and has called him a psycho and a total nutjob. So the widower of Klaus Sudis, is Timothy Klaus Sudis, and the article suggests that he has the strongest case for defamation and the infliction of pain and suffering. So I will leave that for you to read, and probably nothing like that will ever happen. Hey, good news from the House of Representatives. You may recall a few weeks ago, we cited the case after I received an email from Najin in Berkeley. And she's the one who owns a physical therapy operation, a little shop. I think she had 8 employees or something like that. And she went through all the hoops, and she was extended a loan under the Paycheck Protection Program of the so-called CARES Act. And she was complaining that the fine print made it impossible for her to use it and get forgiveness of the loan according to its terms. Well, the House has changed those terms in a near unanimous vote, 417-1, and that happened today. The bill would give small businesses up to 24 weeks, it was 8, to use the loans and extend the deadline for rehiring workers from June 30th to the end of this year. It would also give small business the ability to spend more of the money on non-payroll costs. So there's more detail to it, but that is a victory. It shows that somebody is actually listening in Washington. As you know, we have been collecting money from listeners, and I chipped in a bunch of cash from my own pocket and from subscription revenues since April 15th. And today, yesterday, I went to the P.O. box, and I got a lovely note from Maria Neri in Sugar Land, Texas. I think that's in the Houston area. She says, "Hi, Peter. Please accept this as a token of appreciation for what you do to keep us sane. I'm a retired nurse and a daily listener. I'm also in a position to be able to share some stimulus. If possible," she wants half of this to go to me and half for listeners in need. Well, I am going to politely overrule that, Maria, and put the entire $200 check that you sent into the community fund here. And I have a request for a $100 grant today from our long-term supporter, Terry Paris, who is in Berkeley. She's getting ready for surgery, and she is going to need to hire somebody to help clean and move things around before she goes into the hospital. And so we are going to be funding her request, and you'll be seeing your PayPal account later today, Terry, with a $100 addition. And in Minneapolis, we've seen a very strong reaction from protesters, including some looters who've taken to the streets. There's been property damage, confrontations at a local police station, all because of the police killing caught on video of African-American George Floyd. And while I never condone looting, one can certainly understand that the anger that builds up when on a routine basis the police harass, physically abuse, and in certain cases, with impunity, kill somebody, in this case, and it's asphyxiation. Well, it is hard to really imagine how to deal with that kind of built-up anger. And we're learning some details. You know, they first said that George Floyd had committed some, he was being investigated for forgery. Then they said he tried to pass a bad check. And now we are hearing that they are investigating an accusation that he used a fake $20 bill in a transaction that led to the police picking him up. Now, number one, I point out that this story is shifting, and that's because the police lied. And they do it all the time. They write up reports that have no connection to what really went on. And I don't know the particulars of what happened. I don't presume to have that kind of knowledge. But I can certainly make the case that I might have a fake $20 bill in my wallet right now, and it may have come out of a bank ATM, an automatic 20 machine. I think that's what those letters stand for. And so what we may find out later is that this police officer, Chauvin, may have had a history with George Floyd, and this was just a pretext. And the protest that led to a police crackdown, we have now one reported fatal shooting near a looted pawn shop. We don't know if it was the pawn shop owner. We don't know if the pawn shop owner shot at somebody who was trying to loot his pawn and jewelry shop. But it saddens me. I also just want to commend the local mayor. He has been very strong in his language. His name is Jacob Fry. And we rarely see that. We see a lot of euphemized media coverage. On the PBS NewsHour last night, they referred to this as an officer-involved death. They love that passive description. Yeah, the officer was just involved. No, he was the perpetrator. This is a police killing in broad daylight, captured on video, objected to by passersby. But all of that gets sifted out. And this is from Facebook, and it is a flyer, a handout, that was distributed in Minneapolis at the protest. So consider the source. It may not all be 100% accurate. But police officer who killed George Floyd, the restraint technique was not part of the department training. He's being represented by Tom Kelly, the same attorney who got Officer Geronimo Yanez, who murdered Philandro Castile, acquitted. Derek Chauvin was put on leave in 2011 for an inappropriate police shooting of Alaskan Native American Leroy Martinez. He shot Ira Latrell Tolles, an unarmed black man, age 21, in 2008. Chauvin was one of the officers who murdered Wayne Reyes, a Latino man with 16 bullets. Chauvin and another officer were chasing a car in 2005, causing the death of three people. And there are 12 police brutality complaints against him. And as the mayor lamented yesterday, why isn't this guy in jail? And at this hour, I haven't heard that he has been arrested. He was immediately fired from the police department. But that certainly is not justice. I have linked to David Sirota's latest newsletter, TMI, where he works over the word loot and looting. And he brings up the Merriam-Webster definition. The first is to plunder or sack in war. And the second definition is to rob, especially on a large scale and usually by violence or corruption. And Sirota intones, headlines this morning are all about looting, specifically looting in Minneapolis after the police killing of an unarmed African-American man was caught on video. In modern vernacular, that word looting is loaded. It comes with all sorts of race and class connotations. And we have to understand that terms like looting are an example of the way our media often imperceptibly trains us to think about economics, crime, and punishment in specific and skewed ways. Working-class people pilfering convenience store goods is deemed looting. By contrast, rich folk and corporations stealing billions of dollars during their class war is considered good and necessary public policy, aided and abetted by arsonist politicians in Washington lighting the crime scene on fire to try to cover everything up. And I invite you to read this. I think it's very strong stuff. He shows 10 examples of looting that doesn't get called looting. 1. The Fed bailed out the investor class. 2. Millionaires reap 80% of the benefit from tax change in the coronavirus stimulus. 3. Stealth bailouts shovels millions of dollars to oil companies. 4. The tax break bonanza inside the economic rescue package. 5. Wealthiest hospitals got billions in bailout for struggling health providers. 6. Airlines got the sweetest coronavirus bailout around. Then large troubled companies got bailout money in small business loan program. 8. Public companies received $1 billion meant for small businesses. 9. Firms that left U.S. to cut taxes could qualify for federal aid. That's like the cruise ships. And number 10, the K Street bailout. And that's the one that we detailed in our recent podcast with Andrew Perez and Adam Eichen. I don't have any special commentary on the Central Park confrontation between a white woman named Amy Cooper and a black man named Christian Cooper. Christian was birdwatching when Amy was walking her dog. They exchanged words. He videotaped her as she called the police. And while he was a little bit sassy, it appears, he stood his ground. And Amy Cooper's been fired from a high-paid job at a hedge fund or some kind of an investment bank. And Christian Cooper has questioned whether that is going too far. Well, we know who the Good Samaritan is in the exchange between the Coopers in Central Park. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. Worldwide, the COVID-related death count is at 356,000. In the United States, it did cross 100,000. And my local paper this morning had two stories at the top of the front page, 100,000 deaths nationwide, 100,000 cases across California have now been identified. We have a total of 40 million people who have applied for unemployment over the last 7 or 8 weeks, which is just a stunning number. The Centers for Disease Control has released an updated guidance when you can be around others after you had or likely had COVID-19. It advises those who think they have or had it. You can be with others if you had 3 days with no fever and symptoms improved, and 10 days since symptoms first appeared. So there are a few other criteria as well. In a poll of 1,000 adults conducted by the AP, 49% of respondents said that they will get a coronavirus vaccination when it's available. 31% are unsure, and 20% said that they would refuse it. And there are good reasons to be very skeptical. Vaccines don't always work. There are side effects. The rush to develop this one could lead to cutting corners and accepting risks through limited testing. And then there's the incredible corruption in the profiteering that occurs in the vaccine industry. Billions for defense contractors hidden in the new HEROES Act. This is the one written by Democrats. One element that was written by Virginia Democrat Jerry Connolly would cover executive compensation and other perks for defense and intelligence contractors. Yeah, you don't want to leave the executives behind. I mean, they've got Beamer payments to make and, it's just the sordid kind of looting that David Sirota referred to in my quote a moment ago. Secrecy is surrounding the COVID-19 cases at meat processing plants. And I credit Rachel Maddow. Sometimes it's a little repetitive, but she has done a good job of really scouring the nation using local newspapers and TV reports to show you the coverage that's being missed on the national level. And the meatpacking plants, the Navajo Reservation, these are places that are pretty much off the radar of mainstream media outlets. And the way Republican governors in states that have a lot of slaughterhouses are covering this up for the employers is just disgusting. So Linda has some citations here. A nonprofit group, Food and Environment Reporting Network, also known as FERN, estimated last week the number of coronavirus cases in the meatpacking industry is over 17,000, and 66 meatpacking employees have died so far. Governor Pete Ricketts, Republican of Nebraska, has decided that his administration will no longer provide data of infection rates at specific food processing plants. And a lot of the other big firms say that, oh, we've got to protect the privacy of our families. But that, of course, ignores the impact on communities where the virus can spread. Also, Chris Hedges, a former New York Times reporter and a man with a conscience. I have a lot of respect for him. It's been a while, but I've interviewed Chris on many occasions. He is running for Congress in a district where he lives in New Jersey as a Green Party candidate. Due to the budget impact of the COVID-19 shutdowns, the projections of slow regaining of employment, and that impact on tax revenues, California is facing massive deficits over the next couple of years. And I am pleased to see that Gavin Newsom, our governor, has floated the idea that he wants to close one of the 32 prisons that we have in California as a way to save money. Now, there are a lot of details to be worked out here. And while I have praised Gavin Newsom for his moratorium on executions and some other moves in the criminal justice system, like eliminating the juvenile lockups, he has been very slow and stingy in releasing inmates in our prison system, where we currently have about 113,000 people locked up. But I consider this a promising development. As you may know, Beijing is taking an increasingly strong line in confronting the United States on many fronts. And Pepe Escobar described this in rich detail in our most recent interview, if you haven't caught up with that yet. But yesterday, Mike Pompeo intoned that the new law that's being passed in Beijing that basically imposes full control over Hong Kong in security terms and will suppress any future protests means that they no longer enjoy their special trade and economic status with the United States. But what does that really mean? And it's pretty clear that Beijing is not going to blink. They have accepted the cost of the massive rounds of tariffs that Trump has imposed. And ultimately, this becomes a losing proposition for the United States. Now, I care about the human rights of people in Hong Kong. I care about the rights of the population of Uyghurs, who are said to be under lockdown on a massive scale in far western China, Xinjiang province. But because Trump has been so erratic, first with the trade war, then with the effort to blame China for the coronavirus after he said that they were being so cooperative back in January, that's all for domestic calculated political reasons. I think we're going to lose this one. And the cheap imports from electronics and iPhones and all of our gadgets to all the crap they sell at Walmart at low prices, made in China. We're going to see not only a shortage in our supply chain, but disruption for consumers because many of those products are no longer made in the United States. And the prices that they will fetch if they are made here will be a substantial shock to our consumer economy. This is a really tragic story. A woman who crossed into the United States from Mexico was captured and was being held at the Core Civic private prison called the Houston Processing Center, was about to be deported. And the day before, she and two other women were transferred to a dark and murky cell, isolated from the rest of the prison, where she reports that they were raped and assaulted. Around midnight, three men in streetwear entered the cell and sexually assaulted all of the women. One of them slapped and punched the plaintiff's face before twisting her hand behind her back. Terrified, she tried to resist being raped, but ultimately stopped because her attacker kept hitting her. She was deported the very next day, June 2nd of 2018. And 9 months later, she delivered a daughter. And she claims that she hadn't had sex before or after that rape. And she knows that that rape resulted in her pregnancy. She's now filing suit, and presumably she can develop DNA evidence to identify her alleged assailant. And get this, the Office of Inspector General conducted 570 total investigations of sexual and physical abuse, but only 225 came from a complaint. And the number of cases found to be valid is ridiculously low. These prisons, these immigration lockups, are hellholes. They are gulags. And especially when they're run by these private companies, there is no accountability for the degrading treatment and these kinds of assaults that occur all too often. A couple more quick notes here before I go today. Mitch McConnell is now the target of the Never Trumpers, the Lincoln Project. That's run by Mr. Kellyanne Conway and other Republicans who are disgusted with Trump. And because of McConnell's moves to limit the scope of Trump's impeachment trial, and his other offensive behavior, they are targeting him. Conway said, this is George Conway, when he fixed the impeachment trial by blocking evidence of Trump's high crimes and misdemeanors, McConnell violated and abased the solemn oaths he took as a U.S. senator. Add in the fact that he's managed to do much better for himself than for the people of Kentucky, and it becomes a no-brainer. McConnell has to go. Larry Kramer died yesterday at the age of 84. Back in the 1980s, when AIDS was the pandemic, not limited to, but originating in, the gay community, he was the founder of ACT UP. He was loud, he was obnoxious, he was demanding, and he was successful. Rest in power, Larry Kramer. And finally today, the New York Times has a fascinating piece about a book that I interviewed the authors of back in 1991. It was called Generations. Maybe you remember it. Written by William Strauss and Neil Howe. Bill Strauss was a member of the Capitol Steps, the group that did political satire tunes set to popular songs. That's how I first knew Bill. And then he said, hey, I got this book. Been working on it for years. It's about generations and how American history unfolds in boom-to-bust cycles of about 80 years. And generations accurately predicted the war that occurred in 2003, the financial meltdown of 2008, and Bill Strauss died in 2007. And I have tried to interview Neil Howe, but he declined in the intervening years. At any rate, the Times details what Neil Howe currently thinks, and based on the original research they did for generations. They say that the year 2020, they predicted an event like the coronavirus. He said it was a round number that fit the cyclical nature of their theory, roughly 80 years after the last great crises of World War II and the Great Depression. Historical patterns pointed toward the arrival of a generation-defining crisis that would force millennials into the fire early in their adulthood. And by the way, Strauss and Howe were the first to apply that term to those born in the early 1980s. And it turns out that their prediction is that this will lead to a political rout that could possibly set the Republicans back, for as long as 10 years. And they properly indict the baby boomers, my group, for what we have done to this country. And it turns out that Steve Bannon is a devotee of the Generations book and its history, including the sequel called The Fourth Turning. And that he tried to educate people in the White House about this. He said, I got mocked and ridiculed by so many people. They said, you can't believe in this stuff. It makes you look like a kook. The doubters included the president, who told Bannon that the theory was too dark for him. He said, I'm an optimist. I'm a realist. And this is reality. check out the piece. I'll link to the article in the show file for today's podcast at peterbcollins.com. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You'll find it on YouTube. You're free to share it all over the place. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails.